Meeting of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. We are convened. Good morning to each of you. We're talking about pinnipeds this morning. And when we discussed predation and predators earlier in this committee, many of the committee members voiced concern about increasing populations of pinnipeds and some of the impacts that they're having potentially not only on our fisheries, but some of our coastal and waterway infrastructures in the state. With that, we're very fortunate to have Robin Brown from ODF&W with us and Commissioner Thompson. Gentlemen, if you'd like to come forward, please. Thank you very much for your willingness to appear. Commissioner, welcome back to a committee that you spent a good number of hours in.
And on this subject.
Yes. Please determine the order of your testimonies.
And, yes, you go first. Okay. You're the scientist.
And again, thank you both very, very much for your willingness to appear this morning.
Good morning, Chair Wett, representatives. My name is Robin Brown with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I lead our agency's marine mammal research and a little bit of management program. I'd like to give you a review of the status of seals and sea lions in Oregon, and I have a little bit of a focus on the Columbia River here since that's been a hot topic lately, and recently presented the same information to our commission in the past month. This is a sea lion's eye view of the Lewis and Clark Bridge at Longview and Rainier, taken from a National Geographic critter cam that we attached to the back of a stellar sea lion at Bonneville Dam. He immediately left the area, swam downriver to Astoria within a day, and we recovered the camera later. It's on a float pack when it's released. Wanted to acknowledge our partners in all the work we do with seals and sea lions and other marine mammal issues. Of course, NOAA Fisheries has been one of our greatest supporters, and they fund a very large portion of the work we do. Their National Marine Mammal Laboratory staff work directly with us. Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, of course, is our counterparts. And Pacific States Marine Fishery Commission funnels a lot of the federal funding to us for this work. We work with Army Corps of Engineers, Bonneville Dam at Willamette Falls, Columbia River Intertribe Fish Commission, and, of course, the Power Council and BPA. So we have three pinnipeds, basically, are the most common, California sea lions, the stellar sea lions, and the harbor seals. These are all on the south jetty of the Columbia River that can be any time of year, anywhere from several hundreds to several thousand of them. The California sea lions are the smaller, darker animals, and the stellars are larger, silvery, gold-colored animals. And, of course, everybody's probably familiar with the little harbor seals. Harbor seals are widely distributed throughout the world. There's five stocks recognized in the U.S. Of course, we're concerned with the Oregon-Washington coastal stock. The population increased following protection in 72, stabilized in the 90s, but may be increasing again. The 1999 estimate was about 25,000 animals, Oregon and Washington coast, and we have a 2014 estimate that's pending, may show an increase. These are counts of harbor seals hauled out in the lower Columbia River from the Astoria area up towards Klaskenai at Wallace Slough from 1977 through 2014, and you can see they increased from several hundred animals to several thousand over that period. I would mention, though, that going back into the mid-80s, about the middle of the graph there, we also had counts in the springtime, February and March, when we had very healthy smelt runs that topped 4,000 or 5,000 harbor seals. So we did not have much pup production in the river in the springtime back in those years, but we did have a lot of animals in the river when the smelt returned. The stellar sea lions, there's two U.S. stocks, and ours is the eastern from Gulf of Alaska to Northern California. It numbers about 65,000 animals, had been increasing about 3 to 5% per year, and is still increasing a little rate. They were recently delisted as threatened from the Federal Endangered Species Act because populations have recovered. The western stock remains listed as endangered from the central Gulf of Alaska out to Aleutians to the west. And the Oregon-Washington population is about 8,000 animals, and they produce about 15,000 pups each year. Most of the pups are born on the southern Oregon coast, represented Krieger's area, Rogue Reef, Orford Reef, and at St. George Reef off Northern California. This is where we focus a little more on the Columbia River. People always ask, well, how many are in the river? And I wish we could give a precise answer, but it's really tough. Anytime recent spring counts, maybe 100, 200 on the South Jetty, from between Bonneville Dam and Foca Rock, which is about 12 miles below the dam, there might be 40 or 50 animals. There's a little over 50 there now. Willamette Falls can have two or three stellar sea lions. There's probably another 50 swimming around the river in different places. That's the part that's really hard for us to enumerate those, how many are in the river at any particular time. This is the lower portion of the observed predation at Bonneville Dam by the U.S. Army Corps of Fish Field Unit. It's been studying the predation there since 2002. Stellar sea lions showed up in 2005, and through 2014, they consumed a minimum of 8,000 salmon, and this is within just a quarter mile of the dam because that's all they can observe, and over 12,000 white sturgeon in that period of time. California sea lions, five stocks, just one in the U.S. from California, about 300,000 animals now in this population. It was roughly 20,000 in the 1950s, so the Marine Mammal Protection Act has been a huge success for this species. It's grown at about 5% per year since the mid-70s, except in El Nino years and warm water years, which we're experiencing right now. The females find it hard to find enough forage fish to feed on near the rookeries, so they have to travel farther and farther from their pups on the beach, and sometimes they just don't come back or come back without enough bulk to give them a nice, rich, fat milk, and so the pups' survival in those years is much lower, and that's what we're seeing right now along the California coast. These animals are seasonal migrants in our part of the Northwest. They just primarily males and subadult males, rarely see females. They show up in late summer, and they're here fall through spring, and then they head back to Southern California to the breeding areas. In the Columbia River, the typical recent is in quotes here because nothing's typical or has been typical over the past couple of years with respect to California sea lions. A single day count, there might be 50 to 100 on the South Jetty, 200 or 300 in the East Mooring Basin at Astoria where they haul out on the docks and the jetties, 25 or so at Bonneville Dam. There's three living in the Bonneville Pool at the Dalles. They've locked above the dam 5 years ago and are living on houseboat decks there that makes the residents very happy, of course. And there's about 20, well, actually, this year there's about a little over 30 California sea lions at Willamette Falls right now feeding on salmon and the last of the winter steelhead. Well, historically, in the Columbia River, the archaeological evidence shows that harbor seals were common. They occurred all the way up to Slilo Falls. Over the past 10,000 years, there's records of their remains. Stellar sea lions were seen on occasion in the river, in the lower, say, 50 to 75 miles of the river in the 1800s and early 1900s, but there's no history of California sea lions in the Columbia River. There's no archaeological evidence that they ever occurred there. They always were in the ocean off the Pacific Northwest in some number, but they just never occupied the Columbia River to any degree. In 1972, of course, the Marine Mammal Protection Act was passed. 1980s, the numbers in the river started increasing. 1990s, we started seeing them at Willamette Falls, and that's when we started our marking program at Astoria so that we could monitor their movements and foraging habits in the river. And then, of course, there were a number of ESA listings of Columbia River Basin salmonids in that period of time. 2000s, the animals started showing up at Bonneville Dam, and in 2002, again, was when the Corps started their observation program. Mm-hmm. We started seeing stellar sea lions there in 2006. So this is all, you know, fairly relatively recent occurrence for this issue we've been dealing with for the past 12 years or so. In 2006, our Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission directed us to apply for federal authority under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, Section 120, which allows the states to apply for lethal removal authority for a limited number of predators, California sea lions, non-listed pinnipeds, that are having a significant, not defined in the law, negative impact on the recovery or the decline of threatened and endangered salmon and steelhead. So not sturgeon or anything else. That tool wouldn't allow us to affect any change in the foraging behavior on sturgeon in the area. That authority was granted in 2008, and we recently have started to see sea lion numbers increase again at Willamette Falls. This is our Astoria capture and marking effort. We open a big door on a trap, and they come in there and lay down and take a nice long nap, and then we shut the door, and we pull them off onto a handling barge. We can take blood samples. We can tag them. We can put instruments on them, and we can hot brand them, which is the mark we used for long-term lifetime identification of individual animals, which is one of the requirements for using the 120 authorities. You have to know these animals as individuals, either by marking them or identifying natural marks. Our operation at Bonneville Dam, as you can see, it's labor-intensive, requires a lot of people, a lot of specialized equipment. Well, one of the questions we had was, where do these animals come from that occupy the Columbia River? And so we marked a lot of the animals at Bonneville with satellite packs so we could track their movements. And the area in the upper right is a vertical image of Bonneville Dam, the Oregon side powerhouse, the spillway in the middle, and the Washington side powerhouse. And all of those dots are specific locations for one stellar sea lion from February through April and May. So you can see this animal was foraging basically all over the area. And one thing I like to point out is that if you see the real densely concentrated dots near the structures, that's all the observers can see. So all of that other activity that the animals are carrying out in other areas represents a fair amount of foraging that is not reflected in the estimates of loss that the Corps presents. And then to the left, you can see that during the non-Columbia River season for these animals, the stellar sea lions range from southeast Alaska to northern California, and the California sea lions range from the Washington coast down to the Channel Islands off southern California where they breed. Well, recently everybody's seen the attention of increased seal and sea lion numbers in the Columbia River. This is a photograph taken in February by Washington Fish and Wildlife. It's about a little more than 6,000 harbor seals hauled out on Desdemona sands just off Astoria. And this is a record count. We've never seen that many there. But I remind you again, going back into the mid-80s, we did see counts of 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 animals there during the healthy smelt runs. So this is a influx of seals from the northern Oregon coast, southern Washington coast, maybe a little bit farther than that, to take advantage of the smelt return, which has been really healthy the past couple of years. It's a very oily fish, high in caloric value. It's a highly preferred prey of seals and sea lions. They'll consume it almost exclusively to anything else if it's available. And the same thing, increase in the number of California sea lions. This is the Astoria East Mooring Basin, or part of it, one dock and a float that was dedicated, given away to sea lions, essentially by the port, and our trap there in the upper center. A count of over 1,500 in February, and then in March we had a count of over 2,400 California sea lions in the East Mooring Basin at Astoria. Well, this is kind of the normal pattern of California sea lion abundance in the lower Columbia River, as indicated by the numbers we count in the East Mooring Basin. There's a midsummer lull there in the middle when most of the animals are south at the breeding areas. Then the numbers go up in the fall. We usually get a fall peak as many of these animals are flooding northward. And then it typically declined again through November, December, January to a midwinter low. And then we saw a spring peak again as the animals began moving south again from British Columbia, Washington, stopping by the Columbia River and heading to the breeding areas. Well, that's not the typical example case anymore. These are counts in the basin from 2005 to 2014, and those red lines are the spring peaks. You can see from 2005 to 2012, the peak was around 250 animals in the springtime, February, March. And then in 2013, which was the first good increased return of smelt that we've seen in a decade or more, the numbers jumped to over 700. And then in 2014, over 1,400. And then this year, again, we'll be off the charts there at over 2,400 animals. So a direct response of these animals to the availability of smelt in the river in February and March. So a lot of these animals just flood in from the coast to take advantage of the prey, but also probably the warm water conditions off Southern California forced more animals to the north to find cooler waters and more dense prey aggregations they can take advantage of. Photograph of probably 200-300 California sea lions in the Columbia River near Cathalamet. Foraging on smelt. They're porpoising and just going down, eating, coming up by, you know, they're just going crazy foraging on probably a huge ball of smelt there that's moving up the river. And this will occur all the way up to the cowlets primarily because that's where the bulk of the smelt go to spawn. Some up to the Sandy on the Oregon side. These are mean daily Chinook consumption by California sea lions, and then the mean daily Chinook passage at Bonneville Dam from 2002 to 2014. These are data collected by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Fish Field Unit. The blue line is the passage of Chinook over the dam, and the red line is the consumption of fish by California sea lions. You can see that the pattern matches pretty well. But what's important is the California sea lion consumption of these fish anticipates the arrival of the bulk of the Chinook by anywhere from a week to 2 weeks. So while the Corps may report a loss of 1-4% of the total passage to pinnipeds, these early fish that show up can be lost at rates of 50% or greater. When 100 fish pass a dam early in the season, 100 may be consumed by sea lions on the same day. So the effect of the predation on these early arriving fish is far greater than the passage as a whole. And a lot of these early arriving fish are Snake River fish, many of which are there's great concern for their recovery from low abundance. Well, how many can they eat? We always get the question. The Army Corps of Engineers folks have seen one animal consume 12 salmon in a day. That's the highest they've ever seen for one individual. And one individual took nearly 200 in a season, which is April and May. If you look at their biological prey requirements and model the energetic needs, they consume roughly 3 salmon a day based on the size of spring Chinook we see at Bonneville and the size of sea lions we find there. And at Bonneville Dam, the observed predation from 2002 to 2014 was over 40,000 spring Chinook by California sea lions. Again, that's only within a quarter mile of dam. That doesn't include all the other predation that occurs within another half a mile or another 10 miles or another 150 miles. These are mean and maximum daily numbers of California sea lions and Stellar sea lions at the dam from 2002 to 2014. The blue is California sea lions and the red is Stellar sea lions. If we just look at the lines on the top, you can see that the maximum number of sea lions at the dam increased from 2002 to 2007 and then decreased, as well as the mean daily number decreased once we started our removal program there. So we feel that the removal efforts for California sea lions up until 2013 did appear to have an effect on reducing the number of California sea lion predators feeding right at the base of the dam. But, of course, biology is always complex, and we see increasing numbers of Stellar sea lions over this similar period, which we don't have management authority for at this point in time. And then I would point out that in 2013 and 14, you see the blue line start to climb again. And in 2015, that'll be over 50 animals again, 60 animals maximum this year. So, as a result of that large influx of animals into the lower river, because we are happy to have these great healthy smelt returns, we also see major increases in predator abundance. Well, we've been removing these California sea lion predators, of course, since 2008, and through this year, 2015 so far, we've removed 89 animals, the most dominant predators that are there year after year and the most effective foragers. 13 of those animals have gone to captivity, to zoos and aquaria. There have been 5 accidental mortalities, just unintentional death in handling or on the traps. And then 55 plus the 14 this year have been euthanized chemically by our veterinarians. Well, Willamette Falls is becoming the next real issue for us with these animals. In 2014, we actually had more salmon and steelhead lost at Willamette Falls to California sea lions than we did at Bonneville Dam in the previous 2 or 3 years. Nearly 4,000 salmon were killed, and salmon and steelhead were killed last year at Willamette Falls. That represented 13% of the potential wild winter steelhead passage and 8% of the potential wild Chinook passage. And those are huge numbers. Those are far greater rates of loss than we have ever been able to document at Bonneville Dam. And these are, of course, smaller runs and smaller abundance of particularly the wild winter steelhead, which is the species of greatest concern here. Last year, about 27 California sea lions. This year, we've got over 30 California sea lions. The bulk of them are the same animals that have come back year after year now for 2 or 3 years. 5 of them, they're on the removal list that we could take for their activities at Bonneville Dam. In 2015, the preliminary results so far, again, 33 California sea lions, several stellars. 4 on the removal list. The estimated predation so far is already over 3,000 animals. We've got a whole month to go. It's very likely to exceed what was lost last year by a significant amount. So this is a real developing problem at Willamette Falls. So in the future, we're continuing our projects in Astoria of marking. This is the only way we can really understand their movements and foraging efforts in the river, monitoring their abundance, distribution, and food habits. Continuing our predation removal, predator removals at Bonneville in 2015 and 16, and then with our commission, we'll consider requesting an extension to that management authority. Then Willamette Falls, again, just continue the observations and evaluate the effect of those predators on the listed fish passing the falls. And hope that wasn't too long. That's all I have. Okay. If you think we have too many sea lions in Oregon, just be glad you don't live in California.
Wow.
Thank you, Chair and Representatives.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Vice Chair McLean?
How long is a lifespan usually for the 3 different types of seals?
Too long.
Chair Wett, Representative McLean. California sea lions females exceed 20 years by a year or two. They give birth to a pup every year once they're about 4 years old. Males that breed don't live that long. They have a pretty tough life, fighting each other and going without food during the breeding season for 6 weeks or more. Lived probably 14, 15 years old. And the harbor seals can be in the low 20s as well. And stellar sea lions about the same as the California sea lions.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what is the cost per animal of removal, say, at Bonneville?
Chair Wett, Representative Barreto, that's a good question, and I have to be honest with you, I don't have that answer right now. The National Marine Fisheries Service provides, has been providing since 2008, $150,000 to each of the states of Oregon and Washington to run our combined Columbia River efforts, and that's everything from the Astoria marking and trapping all the way up to everything we do with observing and hazing and trapping and removing and branding new animals at Bonneville Dam. We could sit down and try to figure that out, but the removal effort is a small portion of all of the work that we really do. So the two states are getting $300,000 a year to do this, and it's a fraction of that. I would not hazard a guess without really looking at in more detail.
Vice Chair Krieger.
This is pretty much the Columbia Willamette system. But down the south coast, I got there in 64, which is 50 years ago. Everybody shot him, mm-hmm. including state police. National Marine Fisheries Service was with us when we were doing it. They were just a predator that you got rid of. We really controlled the numbers inside the river to some degree. And they were eating a lot of eels at the time. Which seem not to be there as much as we've got now, mm-hmm. lamprey. I realize what you're doing. I realize what you know, the process. They're a predator. They eat fish, and you can study them for 200 years. They're still going to be a predator. They're still going to be eating fish, and you have to control numbers. Now, that's not, you don't, we're not talking about eliminating them. It has to be a number that is something that we can live with and still have good production of our fish, not lose all that investment. And where I have some concern is with wild fish. You know, they're killing just as many endangered species fish. Now, my understanding was the federal government, you can correct me, I need to know for sure, I'll look it up, that the federal government is required to control predators if they're preying upon endangered species. Is that true?
I would have to look that up, too. I do not believe there's a specific requirement.
I heard there was, so mm-hmm. let's find that out for us.
And there are certainly, under the Endangered Species Act, actions that the federal agencies have to take to promote the recovery of the species that are listed. There's no doubt about that.
And one of those is controlling predation. Okay.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, one other question. I think you probably covered it, but I missed it. The smelt runs bring in the sea lions. How do those smelt runs correlate with the salmon runs?
Chair Witt, Representative Barreto. The smelt, typically in years past, you know, we'd start to see smelt in as early December. A few would come in, and then we'd see more in January, and then the bulk would be February, and then up to the sandy March and April. The spring Chinook throughout the river, well, you know, at Bonneville, let me go the other way. Bonneville, they really don't show up that far up the river until the first part of April, late March, first part of April. They do occur in the lower river, of course, before that, and they may hold up in the lower river for a variety of reasons, water flow, water temperature, and those sorts of things, which can change from year to year. But the smelt, in general, show up a month or two earlier than the spring Chinook do.
So my point being, if they're already in there, the sea lions coming in larger numbers for the smelt, they hang around for the salmon too then?
Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, that's true. And that's the great concern over these past couple of years, where the numbers of California sea lions have increased dramatically. Not all of these animals stay in the river and end up foraging on salmon. Of the more than 2,000 animals we've marked at Astoria over the past 18 years, less than 10% of those individuals have ever been seen at upriver sites like Bonneville Dam or Willamette Falls. So it's a selective group, a small portion of the total 300,000 will come in the river, and a smaller portion of that will go up river foraging for salmonids. But it may be enough to, you know, not benefit the recovery of our listed fish. That's for sure.
Robin, you mentioned, 40,000 Chinook observed to have been killed or eaten at Bonneville. How many would that suggest have been consumed by pinnipeds in that area of the Bonneville Dam total?
For Chair Witt, for example, within a mile or so of the dam, we don't really know, but I've been willing to venture guesses now and then. I think probably the 1-4% of the passage that the Corps reports lost to California sea lions each year, it's probably easily double that within 5 miles of the dam. We spend a lot of time in boats out there following animals, tracking animals, hazing animals, and for example, right now, any time you turn your head, you're going to see a fish killed somewhere just within a mile of the dam. And again, they can only observe a quarter mile of that area.
And you mentioned at Willamette Falls, I think it was 13% of the steelhead and 8% of the salmon. What would the total percentage there be?
Chair Witt, now that one we don't have as good an idea because we really haven't spent the same amount of time in the 1 to 5 miles below the falls that we have at Bonneville now since mid-2000s. We do get reports of sea lions consuming fish, of course, all the way down the river to Portland, all the way down Multnomah Channel to the Columbia River. I'm not sure I'd venture a guess, but, this is obviously going to be, quite a few more than we can observe in the first mile of the dam, of the water below the falls, excuse me.
And I'm interested in pinniped population increases, one, reproduction rates. What are we seeing in terms of total population increase? And secondly, what are we seeing in terms of observable populations here in the waterway, Oregon's territorial waters?
Chair, what the first part of your question, the California sea lions, for example, were increasing at about 5% per year since they were completely protected in 1972. That's probably about the maximum reproductive rate for that kind of an animal. They are now thought to be at or near historic or above historic population levels, and that rate of increase has slowed significantly. The National Marine Fisheries Service is currently considering a determination which would say these animals are at what the law calls optimum sustainable population and may not be increasing at those kind of rates anymore. Harbor seals, as I said, increased also since they were protected in 72. They seemed to level out in the 90s. We had 8 years or more of stable counts statewide, Oregon and Washington. But the last survey we conducted was 2014. It seems the numbers have gone back up again. For harbor seals, we really don't know, what their carrying capacity is for the northwest coast. I can't imagine it'd be a whole lot more than are out there right now, but definitely could be more. And the second part of your question, I'm not sure I understood.
There's a total population increase for the species, but what about the number of residents or visitors here in Oregon, pinnipeds?
Chair Witt, with respect to the harbor seals, they're essentially residents. They move up and down the coast. We've had animals we've tagged in Alsea Bay show up in Central California, for example, but it's kind of unusual. Most of the harbor seals tend to be homebodies. They stay within 100 miles or so of where we might mark them the first time. So when we make an estimate of that population, it probably is what exists in Oregon. At the same time, we saw that stabilization in the mid-90s. The same thing was observed in Washington and in California. So the larger population on the West Coast also seemed to kind of stabilize. I don't know what the current status of that species is in California or Washington. Of course, California sea lions, all of their population change, growth, or decline is all based out of the production that occurs in Southern California. We just get them as seasonal visitors. So when we say there's this many in Oregon, we're really just estimating the number that move north of the breeding areas in the wintertime to expand the range and find more forage fish to feed. So it's not really an indication of the population size. With stellar sea lions, they do breed here. So we have stellar sea lions here year-round. They do move after the breeding period. We've had marked stellar sea lions all the way up into southeast Alaska from the southern Oregon rookeries. But again, we can estimate that population because we do our statewide, and Washington does their statewide surveys in July during the peak of the breeding period. And that's a stable, relatively predictable proportion of the total population that we can photograph and count at that time. So we have a pretty good estimate of the number of stellar sea lions, the total population that occurs in our area.
I know that you mentioned that populations, or at least the rate of increase, may be leveling off some, but I'm going to say that a 5% increase, and I think that was California's stellar... a 5% increase per year is—that's staggering. I mean, in 5 years, were that to continue, I mean, I think we're on the verge here of a potential catastrophe. Anecdotally, I'm aware of folks who are sports fishers in the lower Columbia River. They catch a fish, if they're fortunate enough to hook up anymore because of our hook regulations, but that's another story. It's a race. I mean, folks have gone to saltwater tackle because it's a race to see who gets the fish first. Also, anecdotally, I have sat down in Astoria and watched the pinnipeds attack salmon, throw them up in the air. It has the appearance, although it's some distance, that maybe they're just tearing the bellies out of them. So when you talk about the take of salmon, I don't know if that means how many salmon, total salmon, are consumed, because if we're counting salmon and the whole salmon hasn't been consumed, it's just had the belly torn out of it, I'm wondering if the number is actually greater than what the figures suggest there as well.
Chair Witt, I agree with you. There is some proportion of the fishes that are killed are not consumed in their entirety. But if you're in areas like Willamette Falls or Bonneville Dam, and you're actually on a structure and you can see an animal and you see it kill a fish and then you watch it as it's moving, kind of drifting downriver, if they're given the opportunity, they'll consume just about every single bit of that fish. Now, that we call it the shake and break, because these are big fish, and they bring them to the surface and they snap their head to one side and the other to break them into bite-sized pieces, or at least until they can swallow half of the fish at one time. And sometimes pieces of that are lost, and birds will get them. At Bonneville Dam now, in the past several years, a real interesting problem has developed where the California sea lions are killing fish, consuming a few bites of it, and then the Steller sea lions, which are much bigger and more aggressive, run over there and grab that fish away from the California sea lion, and they consume it. Then the California sea lion, of course, is going to go and try to kill another fish. So it is a complex problem, and the estimates anywhere of fish lost, of course, are very minimal.
They do no good sushi when they see it. Representative Frederick.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, and you don't need to do this right away, but I'd like to see if you can give me a chart of the smelt runs and just how that correlates with some of the, you mentioned it at least a little bit, but how that correlates with the increased number of sea lions, et cetera, coming through, and particularly, I mean, I thought we saw a significant decrease in smelt for a while there, and I'm just curious whether that's correlates at all with the increase in pinnipeds.
Mm-hmm. Chair Witt, Representative Frederick, that's a great point. I'm not going to be able to give you the details of the smelt, but I can tell you, yes, they were very abundant. I started working the Columbia River back in the mid 70s, and smelt all the way through the late 80s were very abundant. They were there year after year. The seals enjoyed them, the birds enjoyed them, the sturgeon enjoyed them, and then there was a decline.
And the people enjoyed them.
And the people enjoyed them. And they were listed under the Endangered Species Act in the late 90s, perhaps. And they were in low abundance for a couple of decades, but now they're coming back again, and I don't know that anybody knows why they've all of a sudden rebounded, but the predators will always follow the abundant prey.
Can I jump in that one?
Sure, please do.
Well, I'm a shrimp fisherman for years. My name's Terry Thompson, and shrimp has a bycatch of Ulacan smelt. There's actually several species of smelt on the coast, but the one you see in the Columbia River is probably the most plentiful one, but there's many other species that are here, night smelt and stuff like this. But it's been normal to have a cycle, but they're very long cycles in smelt. There's some years there's a lot more, and there's some years there's very little. And when I first started fishing back in the 60s, with my 70s with my dad, the smelt were particularly abundant, and then they went down, and they came back, and this cycle wasn't documented well by the biologist at that time, but it could run as much as 20-30% of the fishing mortality. And so it was a natural cycle that we saw with smelt. It went through a deeper decline than I've ever seen before, but I kept trying to tell the biologist, we've seen this happen, they'll come back. Well, they did. But there was one of the things that probably made more smelt to come back than there was before, because it was a bycatch to the shrimp fishery. There was about 20 years there wasn't a lot of shrimp out here either. Mm-hmm. And they came back in real plentiful numbers now, to where this year it may be our biggest fishery since crab is down a little.
Really?
At least in my port it may be. So the smelt population has this decline, but the fishing industry, because of the Endangered Species Act, came up with a new improvement of the bottom of a shrimp net. Shrimp nets usually stay about this far off the bottom, so they don't catch much else, but they do catch smelt. They seem to be at the same level. And they wrapped a light system somewhat similar to, like, you see these little star lights in front of things. They wrapped it on their foot ropes. It was developed actually in Europe. And they've been able to make a dramatic decrease in the amount of smelt they catch out there because of the potential listing. Consequently, I think it is adding to the amount of smelt to come back. And consequently, there's adding then to the sea lions that are chasing those smelt. They're going to feed on something. In this case, that's the most plentiful food available. That's what they're going to chase.
A follow-up on that.
Please, Representative. The other species that interests me are the eels, especially around Willamette Falls. I mean, they were incredibly plentiful at one time.
Lampreys. It's not a true eel.
And I'm just curious about whether they also have a cycle of sorts, and I'm just curious about whether we're in the middle of that cycle as well.
Lampreys go into all the rivers. Some of them are more plentiful than others. I'm not an expert on lampreys. Maybe you can answer that one a little bit.
Chair Witt, Representative Frederick, I don't know. I mean, I don't know the biology of lamprey all that well, but I can tell you that they are also a very highly preferred prey for pinnipeds because they're very oily, very rich in calories, just like the smelt. If they're there, the seals or sea lions will get them. We find remains of lamprey in seal and sea lion diets, either from fecal samples or stomach contents, in areas where people say there aren't any lamprey.
Yep. But there's other species that you got to remember, they're only tracking certain species.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, starry flounders were particularly abundant in all the bays. You can't hardly find a starry flounder in there. And that may be more by seals than sea lions, but seals are more of a secretive feeder. They don't come up and start thrashing stuff on the surface, so you don't see it. And this seal population worries me as a coastal person as much as the California sea lions. You see it, and you see a lot of publicity up here, but you don't see what's going on unless you're a fisherman in the ocean and you're experiencing it. We've had a decline in several species of nearshore fish that aren't commercially caught. We catch them in the bays. But there's nobody really working on those. He's so limited in his funds. And he used to do more work on the coast, but there was such an emphasis on the Bonneville Dam that he hasn't been able to do the work out here. He's one man with one extra staff person.
Thanks to you, sir.
Yeah, he didn't even have a staff person. But in order to be effective in this, we need to be able to look at the whole range of these species, not just the Columbia River. It's a poor point of view if you think that's the extent of the problem, because those that are commercial fishermen and have been around this a long time are all worried about what's going on in the ocean, because if they're going to feed on something, and if they haven't got smelt, they're going to take another species, and some of these species could be put on an endangered species list, and maybe we can't find such a thing as a lighted foot rope to help so we can keep conducting fisheries. Most in Newport, which is the main fisheries port, but in Columbia River also, if we lost those other fisheries, we would be devastated as a community. It's, you know, our total fisheries probably close to 100 million into Newport, and that's just distant water and domestic. Domestic, we're at 50 some million dollars a year into a community our size. That's devastating. And we see this as a potential threat. And yet we don't see enough emphasis by the department because of the importance of the Columbia River. But we need to do this other aspect of science, too. We need a little more funding.
At risk of sounding like a broken record, I would add that Pleuronectids flatfish are one of the primary preferred prey species for harbor seals. Mm-hmm. And the harbor seals in all the coastal estuaries are commonly consuming all species of flatfish. The Oregon coast estuaries are serve as nursery areas for fish like English sole. So there's these small zero-age, one-year-old smelt, or excuse me, flatfish that are running around on the bottom, and the seals just scoop them up. It's what they like to do. And I agree. The stories are that, you know, prior to the years when seals were very, very abundant in the bays and estuaries starting in the early 70s, flatfish were very common and were harvested by sport anglers in all the bays and estuaries. And now it's pretty hard for anybody to find a good-sized flatfish. And then just another point, if I may, Chair.
Please.
So we're kind of talking about these populations and what where are we going with them and what might be done with them. And I just go back to the Marine Mammal Protection Act says that right at the beginning of the act says the intent of the law is to maintain all marine mammals, so including seals and sea lions, as functioning components of the ecosystem, and that their populations should be maintained at optimum sustainable population levels, which Congress didn't determine a value for. 4 years later or so, the National Marine Fisheries Service determined that optimum sustainable population for marine mammals is a range of population levels that's above the number that produces the maximum net productivity every year. So most any population, you reduce it to a point, it's going to reproduce as fast as it possibly can. Then as it gets more and more and more abundant, things like prey, food limitation, diseases, competition, slows that growth rate until you reach a carrying capacity that's the environment, food, the disease vectors, and everything else starts to hold the population at a certain level. So the law says that's the range that marine mammals are supposed to be kept at. Well, there's only been really harbor seals in the Pacific Northwest for which that range has ever been legally determined. Harbor seals are within their optimum sustainable population range, but it's not, and it may be soon determined that California sea lions are by the National Marine Fisheries Service, but for all this other species, we just don't know. And so as long as the federal law says these animals must be maintained within their optimum sustainable population levels, and we don't know what that is, there's no way under the law that as Representative Krieger hinted at, there's no option under the law to try to, you know, keep populations at what some might determine to be a more desirable level. So until, all the way to the end, this is what I always tell all of our constituents, is until enough people are able to convince our federal Congress people that the law is currently not serving their interest as they would like to see it do so, and that in such a way that those Congress people have the ability to stand up in front of the rest of the country and say, we want to change this law so that some of these resource conflicts can be managed. And that might mean removing some predators. There's no sea lions in the North Atlantic Ocean. There's seals to the far north. But you have the three West Coast states. Our Congress people will have to stand up to the rest of the country that only sees these animals in zoos and aquaria and say, we need to have some more management tools. And that's an uphill battle. And until some of those folks have the push to make it happen and the information from us to help them make it happen, we're stuck where we are.
I have kind of a famous story that I've told the legislature, and since you most of you haven't heard it, they'll take a second to tell it. Mr. Krieger knows the story. When I was a kid, there was a dock down here called Lazio's Dock in Newport Waterfront, and there was a woman came down, true story, in a white mink coat with a poodle. And she came down and asked me, she says, oh, those sea lions are so cute. They're such cute critters. And she said, I want to feed one. I said, well, you can go up and buy some herring up there. It's kind of, you know, expensive, but you can feed them with it. At that time, we were just at the beginning of the Marine Mammal Act, and it was against the law, but it was. Anyway, so she came down. This dock was about this high off the water and down next to it, and she takes the package of herring and throws out one. The second one went out, and her poodle jumps in to swim out to get it, like a stick. Well, about this time, a big old bull sea lion came along. No more poodle. This woman, who thought they were so cute, immediately was calling the Department of Fish and Wildlife and wanted management on this animal. And that's the way I kind of determine what's going on with this population. Until it starts to affect the average person, they think it's cute. But if you're a fisherman and you're affected by it, or if you're a person that just comes in contact with them, all of a sudden you find out the cuteness goes away. And that's where we are today. This animal's got so plentiful that it's not cute anymore for the people who are knowledgeable of the situation. Our trouble is trying to convince the rest of the United States these aren't a cute animal. They actually present a threat to the state of Oregon.
Kind of like gun control.
recognize in a moment Vice Chair McLean, Representative Esquivel is on deck, and Vice Chair Krieger is in the hole.
Well, I just wanted to tell you that I thought your presentation was really informational and how important your work is. And it's just amazing the technology you have to be able to put together the body of work that you do have. I know there's more work to be done, but what you have, I think, is a really stellar opportunity for us to really see what I know. I don't usually do that. It really is a good picture. It's a good snapshot of everything that you have. I wanted you to hear this story. In 1947, my dad was a young man, and he had a really special friend who was, at the time, they called him Oregon Game Wardens. Does that sound familiar? Mm-hmm. And they asked my father to climb Haystack Rock to band the seagulls so that they could, you know, see what all of the migration patterns were for those. And we've come a long way from banding to the kind of equipment and technology that you have to really understand the feeding habits, the breeding habits, and all of the other items that are important to make the opportunity to have more management tools, like you were just saying. But amazing presentation, Ian. Really learned a lot.
Chair Witt, Representative McLean, thank you. And just since you're interested in that, currently this year we have deployed a small number of accelerometer tags on the back of the heads of these California sea lions. The instruments are relatively new. They're starting to be used in terrestrial animals and marine animals now. But when that animal picks that big fish up and does this at the surface, that instrument detects that particular movement, and it shows up on the graph like a... It's just day and night. You see the difference in their movement. So we're videotaping with time date stamps those animals at the same time so we can confirm that that's what that indicator is. And with the hope that in the future, or then maybe even next year, we can put more of these instruments out and develop an estimate of how many fish are being killed by an individual animal over and above what can be seen in a day within the observation zone. So hopefully that instrument will give us some of that information.
A little bit of encouragement is some of the data. I'm not sure it's yours, but I know that Marine Science Center has now got a person that does some seal work. Mm-hmm. Is they've learned that these seals go back to the same area to feed, so they may not have to interact with all the population. They may be able to find, let's say, population areas where there needs to be management, and then be able to manage some of the predators directly with that mm-hmm. animal that's causing the problem. So.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that Vice Chair Krieger will acknowledge that on the Rogue River at times, when you fish right at the mouth, we have the same problem. In fact, it's kind of like, am I going to get a half a fish mm-hmm. or am I going to reel in a whole fish? Because the chances are very good you're going to have a big chomp taken out of that fish. So we have the same problem down in Southern Oregon as you do up here as well in the Columbia. If you start doing some mathematics here and you figure out what's happening with the salmon and steelhead fish population with the sea lions and the seals. And then you add in the cormorants. Well, these fish are taking a beating. So no wonder people get upset because they can't catch anything. So anyway, we have to work on that. As for tagging and banning, that they still ban a lot of migratory waterfowl. In fact, there's rewards out for them. You get turn in a ban, you get $50 or $100 or whatever it is. So, but anyway, thanks for your work. I appreciate it.
Vice Chair Krieger.
You've heard me say before that any time the federal government gets involved in management of natural resources, it turns into a quagmire of bureaucracy that nobody can work through. I'd like to see all management of all natural resources away from them people. And the people back east that represent us, whether you go back to Hatfield, to Wyden, I don't care who it is, don't care what party they belong to, they have never represented us on natural resources. Wyden's committee had the authority to change who had standing to sue under the Endangered Species Act, and he did nothing. Now, recently I heard that there was 50% of the spring Chinook were being taken by pinnipeds in the Columbia. Sometime about a month ago, I want you to comment on that. And then also, there was supposed to have been a study, I thought it was on the LC, where 23% of the adult coho were being taken. Do you have any information on those?
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger. Yes, I think the information on the LC you're referring to is a study that we initiated in the late 90s when, well, actually mid-90s, 97, when the wild coho return in that system was extremely low and at great risk. So we did our usual thing of capturing and tagging animals and marking them so we could track them. We had observers out all through the lower 12 miles of the river, all the way up to Tidewater, from September through November. And our biometrician developed a sampling plan and did the analysis on the data. And when we finally got everything going, which was, you know, getting good work done, which was about 2001, 2002, we estimated that about 17% of the coho were being consumed by harbor seals each year. But what, you know, complicating that whole thing is that from 1997 through 2002, the wild population of coho started to return and increase. The hatchery production on the river was eliminated, and I guess at some point it was determined that things were looking better and that the concern for the harbor seal predation didn't rise to the top of the list of things to deal with. But we did make that determination. As far as the Columbia River situation, Dr. Michelle Rube with National Marine Fisheries Service at Hammond, at Astoria area, has been conducting a mark and recovery effort for spring Chinook in the top of the estuary. So prior to her work, there really hasn't been any estimate of how many of the spring Chinook that enter the lower river actually make it to the first passage site at Bonneville Dam, upriver fish. So she has been capturing and tagging fish using acoustic tags and radio tags and pit tags, different things, and then taking a sample, a scale, so they can determine if that's an upriver fish through the genetic examination or not, and then monitoring how many of those fish actually make it to Bonneville Dam and pass the dam. And she presented this information for the first couple of years to the North Pacific Power Planning Conservation Committee. And there were a lot of media, there were several media folks in the audience, and it kind of went viral. But Michelle was very clear to say her work is really very preliminary. And those estimates of loss of somewhere between 25 to 45% of all of those fish are very, very preliminary. They haven't been peer-reviewed by other scientists. So I would take that information with a bit of caution at this point until she's able to do a few more repetitive studies and get some of that information analyzed further. But having said all of that, I don't think there's any doubt that a large, you know, a much bigger portion of those fish are being taken throughout the river by California sea lions than you can determine by standing at any one spot.
Rob, just a little follow-up. I understand what you're saying, and it could vary from year to year depending on water conditions and flow and temperature and all these things. But when you're talking 25 to 45%, that's of what? Of 100,000 fish, 200,000 fish expected to return? Then you take that and you look what the value is of that as either a commercial product or a recreational product for people to be out there making an opportunity to fish. How do you determine what that number is?
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, that's a good question. And you're right that when we talk the percentages in Michelle's work or the folks that stand at the dam and count the number of fish that are lost, the percentage value can fluctuate greatly from year to year based on the total run size. In fact, some of the lowest reported losses, so say 1 to 1.5% by the Corps over the past 10 years, has been because the run has been well over 200,000 fish, close to 250,000 fish. Well, roughly the same number of salmon and steelhead are taken each year. Varies up and down as well. But the percentage changes largely because the size of the run changes.
Could I touch on another short subject, and that's the Marine Reserves?
Please.
This animal has a potential to impact the science, and we're not looking at the problem. If you create a marine reserve and you take the boats that fish in it and you move them out, under the theory of the marine reserve, the population is going to come up. But when you have a population that's high in the marine reserve of fish and you have a somewhat less around it, guess where the predators are going to wind up going to eat? They're going to go where the densest population is. So if you don't monitor and check that, you really don't know how effective your marine reserve is. Whether it's what the effect is needs to be monitored inside of it, and we're not doing that work. So basically, without that factor figured in, we'll never get to really find out how effective the marine reserve is.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions. One, when the mammals were put on the ESA list, was it because of they were seen as a nuisance and they were shot, by fishermen? Is that why the numbers went down? And then, if the numbers got to the point where they needed managed again, and by some chance we got the federal government to okay that, is there a byproduct off the animal as far as skin, meat, and other things that are beneficial?
Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, I'm a little confused on the first part of your question. Most marine mammals are not listed under the Endangered Species Act, although some are. The great whales are.
Okay.
Stellar sea lions.
Let me rephrase that. They're protected.
All protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act 72, correct. And prior to that, most of the states had bounties, and so the animals were killed for bounty. They were also just killed because they were viewed as predators and competitors. And then that's essentially one of the reasons why the numbers were kept lower over the years. And it's also why they weren't very common in the bays, estuaries, and lower rivers of the Pacific Northwest. Excuse me, I forgot the second half.
The other one was, if they opened a harvest season on them or whatever, as far as what they're... Are they good eating?
Yeah, I that's a tough one. Natives in Alaska consume a lot of different marine mammals, and they will tell you some taste better than others. A bearded seal apparently is a very delicious meat. But most of the population probably in the area where these animals occur, the west coast of the U.S., lower west coast of the U.S., I doubt there'd be much of a market for any consumptive purposes. The other issue about the animals is that these animals, seals and sea lions in our area of the world, do not have pelts. else that are of any real value. The fur seals and some of those other animals have a very thick under fur that can be treated and made into a high quality fur product if that's what someone wanted to do. But these animals don't have that under fur, so the pelt, I suppose you could talk about some kind of leather material. They can also be, you know, rendered for oil, which is what they were used for hundreds of years in certain areas. But a lot of those things are unpalatable to most people in the U.S. at this point in time, so I'm not sure how far that would get.
There is some record of ancient Indians that were first here when the first explorers came across the Al Sea. One of the people that was one of the first, he was a writer, I guess from San Francisco, and he talks about making contact at Seal Rocks with the Indians there and found them. He thought there'd be more seals than there was, but when he got to the Aquinnah, he found sea lions, and the Indians preferred the sea lion meat. Well, remember, they didn't have many choices. That was a big predator that was a big animal that was fairly easy to catch, but the oil was an important part from the seal, and they also apparently liked the seal skin, had more uses, but that's just one man's writings from a long time ago, but give some indication. There was a time when they would eat it, but I don't think you're going to see sea lion burgers quickly at McDonald's.
Representative Frederick.
Follow that line. I want to go the other direction. The seals, certainly the seals, have predators as well. Orcas, etc. And I know that there's some work that was done at OSU regarding sharks and some predation on seals and sea lions as well. Do you know have we hit their predators too hard for them to help naturally?
Chair Witt, Representative Frederick. That's a question that always comes up, and I don't know that I can answer it very well. If you look at the two natural predators that are most likely to take seals and sea lions, as you mentioned, the killer whale and sharks, primarily white sharks, most likely. I don't know. This is not my area of expertise, but I can tell you that the killer whale population in the Pacific Northwest is not as probably as healthy and abundant as it used to be. Of course, they were captured many for display, and the southern resident population is listed now. The population abundance has been low and bumps up a little bit, bumps down a little bit. But you can't seem to get a recovery going there. I don't know that we know the population and abundance of white sharks in the Pacific Northwest and what trends might have been. We often see seals or sea lions wash up on the beach with a large shark bite out of the middle of the body, so it does happen. We know that white sharks are very common around the Farallon Islands off San Francisco, where there are elephant seal colonies, stellar sea lions, and harbor seals, and quite often it's observed by the bird biologists that are out there all the time that a lot of the young pinnipeds are taken by white sharks there. But that seems to kind of be an anomaly, that we just don't have reports of common shark predation on pinnipeds in many other areas. So I think that's an open question. We just really don't know.
I asked because I saw evidence of orca predation on seals in the San Juans at one time. So I was just curious about whether that was something that we were seeing or anyone was studying at this point. So.
Well, I'm kind of here for local color in this case. Last year, coming into Depot Bay with my small boat that I used for hook and line rock cod, I got stopped at the mouth of Depot Bay. You know how small it is. There was like six killer whales there. And I think they could smell the seals inside on the rocks, but Depot Bay has such a sharp smell. And they stayed right in that channel. I couldn't go through without interfering with them. It's uncommon, but every year I see a few come up the beach and they're hunting for some seals. I'm sure they find some. Occasionally they come into Aquinnah Bay. I've seen several. But because the Army Corps of Engineers built a rock wall instead of a wood wall, the sea lions now have a place to haul out. When they didn't have that, they used to be in more in the middle of the bay. And the killer whales would come in and circle them, and they could kill quite a few out of a... But it's just, they changed, the Army Corps of Engineers, without knowing it, changed the ecosystem in that bay and took away some of their... the killer whale's ability to
federal capture. Government again.
Well, we needed the breakwater. I think should have built breakwaters that weren't so easily accessible with a standard sheet pile or a wooden wall breakwater, which can do the same thing. They deteriorate faster, but they are a lot harder for the sea lions to use for a protected area.
Yeah. Well, Terry, we've asked so many questions, we probably ruined your presentation for you. And
actually,
for that, I apologize.
I'm here strictly for local color. He
All
is
right.
the expert. I believe in what he does.
Like 17,
I'm glad to answer any questions. I do fish. I work around the animals all the time. I'm concerned about it. All the people with a lot of years of experience are concerned about it. I've been fishing in one way or another in the bays now for... Well, I started on it, that'd be 65 years, and so I've seen a lot of things happen. I'm concerned about the general ecosystem. We keep talking about ecosystem-based management, but we don't seem to be willing to step up and deal with the issues in this particular instance. And I believe very much in the program and the work that he's done.
Yes. Well, thank you. And if you had anything else you wanted to offer in terms of commentary?
No, I'm the local color.
All right. Committee members, anything further?
Just one quick question.
Yes, Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your work, OSU has a pinniped system. How closely are you able to work with them? Are they able to provide any, because you have only one other person right now, are they able to provide any more capacity for you?
Chair Witt, Representative Frederick, Dr. Marcus Horning with the Marine Mammal Institute is their pinniped biologist, and he has several students, I think a couple of postdocs. And we have worked directly on a number of projects cooperatively. And we're always open to doing that. Currently, Marcus is doing some work with harbor seals and capturing and marking animals with some instrumentation to try to get at a little bit more of a broad ecological understanding of how they're interacting with these other resources on the coast. I'm not directly involved in that project. We share capture equipment and that sort of tools and things, and he's helped us out on a project or two. So there is a collaborative agreement there. We work together when the interests coincide.
Okay. Just curious.
I'm fortunate enough to know Marcus and talk to him about his science because it's an interest of mine over over a beer. I don't drink, so. But he has found out that the seals go out to 100 fathoms. I was shocked when I saw that.
100 fathoms?
That's 600 feet. It's about anywhere from 15 to 20 miles offshore. And I fished out there, and I didn't see them. But seals are a lot more seductive in the way they sit in the water and stuff, so it doesn't surprise me. I'm used to seeing sea lions around, but not the seals. But yet his records show that they're out there feeding, and it's certain animals that tend to go to that deep, which is really surprised me. I was able to get to that depth and feed.
Yeah.
So there's always new, more good science, and we have a lot to do. The area that I'm worried about is right in the wintertime. We don't do a lot of science, and I see a lot of seals feeding right in the surf line. I don't know what all they're catching, but there has to be something there that they're impacting at the time when I always say the part of the ocean that worries me most is what happens in the winter, because that's when you have the least amount of fish. And I don't know much about that area. I just see them there all the time, and I don't know if you do, what they're feeding on in there.
We've had reports from sport anglers, what do they fish for there in the surf zone? And they throw those big poles and throw them all the way out there.
Greenling, redfin, perch if they're in the perch. Surf, but this seems to be in the rocky areas.
That's what I was thinking was the surf perch.
Yes.
And I wouldn't doubt that seals, you know, obviously seals and sea lions consume almost any type of fish that's locally and seasonally abundant. So if they're in there foraging like that, I imagine they're taking, you know, whatever's there. And I think surf perch is the one we've had reports about from anglers.
Yeah, red-tailed surf perch is the common one to be right on the surf line. But in the winter, they're just south of Depot Bay, almost where the Marine Reserve is at. And it's a little hard to see exactly where the Marine Reserve is, but we see a supply of, and they're just patrolling back and forth up and down that area. So there's got to be something there that they find they like.
Well, gentlemen, with that, thank you so very, very much for your presentations, making yourselves available, and particularly your patience with all our many questions. Your appearance is greatly appreciated. Thank you.
I consider this an opportunity to present a problem in a big picture. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Scott Beckstead. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Scott Beckstead, Senior Oregon Director, Western Regional Director for the Humane Society of the United States. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today about Oregon's pinnipeds. I did submit written testimony yesterday. I know that letter makes me look really, really smart and like I'm in command of all sorts of technical data, but I confess that most of that data came from my colleague Sharon Young, who works for HSUS all day, every day on marine mammal issues. But hopefully that will at least be helpful as you consider the issue of pinnipeds. So the basic position of the Humane Society of the United States is the same as it's been for several years now, which is that it's bad policy to, you know, blame these predators for all of the declines in salmon and other valuable fish. And, you know, when you think about it, the sea lions and the salmon have had their dynamic going on for many thousands of years, and you know, there are naturally occurring cycles of the populations for both species, and so the question is, you know, what's changed and why are we here today? And that's really, I think, sort of where the rubber meets the road on this issue, because we have the issue of dams and their effect on salmon that are attempting to spawn. We have a large number of commercial fishermen, anglers, gill netters, tribal fishermen. And then, of course, you also have the fact that the ocean is warming, and we've seen just over the past several months that, you know, large numbers of young sea lions are washing up on the beaches in Southern California, emaciated and not fed. Their mothers apparently have abandoned them. And you've got these high numbers of these pinnipeds that are now showing up further north, and in particular in Oregon beaches and estuaries and rivers. So, you know, when you look at what is happening with that dynamic, it's important, we believe, to look at the other causes of mortality. One of the big factors, and this is discussed in my testimony that I submitted, is the fact that the Columbia River is still populated by non-native game fish species, and according to the National Marine Fisheries Service, those non-native game fish are consuming upwards of 2 million baby salmon a year, and that's significant. And I would submit far more than what the pinnipeds are eating. Just to sort of give my take on this, I lived in Waldport. I moved to Waldport right out of law school in 1991 and lived there until I came to work for the Humane Society in 2008. And from 2002 to 2007, I was the mayor of Waldport. And so I became closely familiar with the economic issues affecting coastal communities, and in particular the importance of the commercial fishing industry and the sport fishing industry. I also know, however, that these animals, the seals and sea lions, are an enormous attraction for tourists. People who visit Newport want to go down to the bayfront. They want to have the experience of seeing those great big sea lions on the docks. In Waldport, I could walk out behind my house to the beach and look out and see the harbor seals playing in the Alsea Bay. It's something that the people of Waldport really enjoy. It's part of the culture and part of what it means to live in that part of the state. And so when we look at strategies for managing or dealing with these predators, I just want to urge our policymakers to consider the importance of these animals, the fact that a lot of people, and you know, whenever there's a story in the news about sea lions being caught and branded or caught and euthanized, you know, our membership just here in Oregon just lights up. And there are a lot of people who feel very deeply about these animals, and there is a great deal of a feeling or the sentiment among them that these animals should be protected and treated humanely. So I will leave it at that. I'm certainly happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Scott, thank you very, very much.
Yes, thank you.
Is there anyone from the public who would like to make comment here this morning? Last and final call? All right. Seeing no one, I'm going to close the informational hearing on pinnipeds. Thank you all very, very much. Mr. Gallagher, what do we have for upcoming events?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on Tuesday, May 5th, we are going to have an informational session on permit reform opportunities with a focus on rural economic development opportunities in terms of mining and water permit reform. And on Thursday, May 7th, we're going to have an overview of aquatic invasive species issues, and we're going to look at Senate Bill 248, which involves the hiring of an invasive coordinator, and we're also going to look at the Joint Memorial Number 9, which encourages action on quagga mussels.
Very good. Thank you.
Important.
And committee members, at this point, we only have three bills assigned to our committee. Apparently, that's not out of the ordinary this session.
Senate doesn't do much.
No, they don't.
And what they do stand over isn't any good.
Well, but the upside of that is there's not a lot of bad that can be done with those numbers. So.
That's right.
So
we
are going to probably have a couple more information hearings. We know that we're going to have a hearing for one of Representative Barreto's constituents also. So at this point, our workload looks relatively light going forward. And until all of the bills are over here, we won't know. But please stay tuned. Okay. Mr. Gallagher will keep us posted.
Thank you.
With that, committee members, unless there's anything more for the good of the order, not seeing anything, we are adjourned. Thank you all very much. Thank you all very much. Anything? We are adjourned.